Delhi is one of the world's oldest cities. It's a sweltering, dusty metropolis of over 20 million people that's in the midst of urban transformation, and its population is expected to rise 40% by 2020. Aman Sethi writes about it in Free Man, a true story of life and death in Delhi, which is set in the Sadar Bazaar, the oldest and largest wholesale and retail market in Delhi. In his book, Mr. Sethi, a reporter for The Hindu, one of the largest English-language newspapers in India, explores the lives of a group of day laborers struggling for work and for freedom in a society that's going through a whirlwind of modernization and change. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Does everyone in Delhi shop at the Sadar Bazaar?
No, Sadar Bazaar is a wholesale market. So, I mean, if you want to buy, I don't know, 5 tons of clothes, you could probably shop at Sadar Bazaar. But otherwise, it essentially retailers shop there and then kind of sell.
And when I say it's oldest, how old is it?
Sadar Bazaar is sort of from the Mughal period. So you would say at least more than 300, 400 years old.
How would you describe the neighborhood of Baratuti Chowk?
It's in the center of the city, which is sort of interesting because if you read about Sadar Bazaar, it feels like it's in the periphery, but it's in the center, and over a period of time, it's been surrounded by more modern sort of parts of the city. So it's sort of gone lost over a period of time. Once you enter Sadar Bazaar, it's very different from the rest of the city in that the roads suddenly narrow down to sort of capillaries, and the housing was all sort of mixed, so a lot of people kind of live on the first floor, the second floor, or in the basement, and then have a shop at the ground level. And like I said, it's full of all sorts of goods. So you could be walking down one street and all you'll see is cotton wool, and you could be walking down another street and you'll smell spices, and third street all plastic, fourth street all metal. So it's sort of like walking through a kind of museum of the present with all these various objects where you're like, one store only sells steel spoons of various sizes endlessly. So,
well, but this is in a city that's going through an incredible transformation. I'd imagine that the property in the middle of town would be very valuable and there'd be pressure to move this all out to somewhere in the periphery.
Yes, there are many, many reasons that Sadar Bazaar increasingly feels under threat. One, of course, is, as you said, property prices, except that what saves Sadar Bazaar is that the plots are really small. They're really small plots, and often ownership of these things is kind of, it's up for grabs because, you know, there have been families that have owned plots and then kind of divided, so they're competing claims. So I guess developers are wary of such competing claims. The other reason to possibly move it out is because it's in the heart of the city. Moving stuff in and out of Sadar Bazaar is becoming harder and harder every day. So there's a section in the book where a truck is described as sort of tiptoeing. And it's really interesting because you've got these massive trucks kind of just inching along behind bureaucrats and kind of pedestrians.
And why is Delhi growing so quick, so extraordinarily, 40% increase within the next 8 years?
I think that Delhi, like many developing countries developing cities in South Asia, is part of a larger pattern of urbanization. So,
but it's a capital city.
It is a capital city,
and it's not the leading business city, isn't that Mumbai and Calcutta to a lesser degree?
Well, Calcutta over the years has really gone through a decline, and there has been talk about, you know, a need to kind of get Calcutta back kind of working. Bombay is the financial capital of the city, of the country, but Delhi is the kind of political capital. It's where a lot of new businesses are coming up in the peripheral areas around Delhi. So, yeah, that's why it's kind of attracting a lot of migrants from the north.
Who is Mohammed Ashraf? Is he the free man of your book's title?
Yes. Mohammed Ashraf is a man who is a painter, a house painter, a butcher, a tailor. He lives on a pavement in Sadar Bazaar, the area we just described, and he wakes up every morning in search of work, like many of his friends, and works through the day, is paid at the end of the day, and goes back to sleep on the pavement where he woke up.
So he's a homeless man, and yet he studied to be a biologist, didn't he?
Yes. Mohammed Ashraf kind of came from a very poor family, but his mother worked in the house of a doctor. And so the doctor was very interested in Ashraf. And so Ashraf was in first-year college studying biology. And then there are a series of unfortunate events which result in Ashraf kind of being on the streets.
The doctor was killed.
The doctor was killed.
Why? Was this a political thing?
No, the doctor is killed, in fact, by the land mafia, surprisingly. And it's at a time where the doctor has rented his house out to a tenant who has a dubious past, and the tenant doesn't want to let go of the land. So next thing you know, gets the doctor killed.
What was the first thing you noticed about Mohammed Ashraf when you met him?
The first thing I think I noticed about him was this kind of incredible personal magnetism and eloquence.
Not the sort of person you'd expect to be living homeless on the street by choice.
Precisely. Of course, through the course of the book, you wonder about this idea of choice, because it's a difficult subject to figure out whether anyone is in their personal circumstance out of choice or out of compulsion. And in Ashraf's case, this question seems to dog him through the book and through his life.
But he had a choice when he first came to Delhi. He turned down regular jobs. He chose instead to be a day laborer, which is not the most secure position.
Yes.
And there's a pecking order, isn't there, among day laborers? Where is he in the pecking order?
I think it depends on – the thing about him is – so the pecking order is based on skill, right? So the more skilled you are, the higher up in the pecking order you are. And the interesting thing about working with your hands is, as I discovered as someone who doesn't really work with his hands so much, was this kind of love of craftsmanship or karigari, as we call it, where the fact that your fingers are so supple and so in control that it allows you to do work of a certain amount of intricacy is valued, which I found personally very, very valuable. Now, Ashraf can do all these things.
But caste doesn't play a role in this pecking order?
Caste intersects with work and class in a very complicated way in India. One, of course, is that certain professions are practiced by certain castes. But when it comes to manual labor is usually performed by anyone who's poor. Now, given that caste also controls opportunity, it means that if you're upper caste, you're likely to have more opportunities, a better education, and more family wealth. So most of the people on the streets are usually lower caste.
Among the more entrepreneurial laborers, there isn't a lack of ideas for how to make money. Did anyone you met there have an idea that actually took off?
Well, yeah, there is one person who I profiled, this woman called Kalyani, who sort of strikes upon the most bizarre sort of entrepreneurial scheme. So as I had mentioned to you earlier, that Sadar Bazaar is a collection of various wholesale markets with these kind of trucks that come in and out. And one small part of it is a grain market. And Kalyani figures out that when these trucks are moving in and out of these, you know, these silos, these grain silos, they end up scattering a lot of very valuable and very high-quality grain on the ground. So she follows the truck, sweeps it up, goes home and cleans it, and then sells it at a premium to kind of the lower end of stuff, but of course significantly marked down. And I thought that was just amazing. It blew me away, this idea.
How were you regarded when you first went into the Bharatuti to interview these people?
I think that, in all honesty, I think I was originally regarded as some sort of a kook who would show up and, you know, ask questions and not ask the kind of questions that reporters normally ask, which is, you know, tell me about hardship or tell me about earnings. But I would ask questions like, what do you think about leisure? Or what do you do for leisure? Or, you know, what do you think about love? And the idea being to try and ask questions that didn't reduce people to their professions, but actually tried to understand them as people.
But I suspect some of them were aware of the newspaper you worked for, or was the fact that it was an English language newspaper totally foreign to them?
No. I told them, of course, very early on that I work for this newspaper. And in fact, in the first story I did and how I found these people was because I was working on a story. So the first time I met them, we went through the usual drill of, you know, questions of, you know, where are you from, how much do you earn, etc. And then I came back, and I think what surprised them was that I came back, because as reporters, we tend to go to a place, kind of write about it and move on. So I think once I came back, I think things became more kind of interesting.
My guest is Aman Sethi, S-E-T-H-I. His book, A Free Man, A True Story of Life and Death in Delhi. You went to Columbia School of Journalism. Does that give you a different approach to journalism than some of the other people you work with? Because, as I understand it, India is a country where journalism is highly prized, and newspapers still thrive, unlike this country.
Well, yeah, I think going to a different country is always a good idea, because it helps you think about your own country differently. And in India, of course, like everything else, we're always in a hurry, and everything is kind of slapdash and very, very fast-paced. And coming to Colombia allowed me some time to kind of take some time off and look at the country from a distance. I also happened to come and study financial journalism in the year that Wall Street crashed. So it ended up being this kind of really interesting perspective, because, of course, there were people back home saying that, you know, we didn't open up the economy as fast as people said we should have, and it seems to have worked out for us. So it was a very, very kind of interesting time.
And then you went back to cover the boom.
Yes.
Well, getting back to Mohammed Ashraf, what reason does he give for not looking for accepting full-time work?
So for Mohammed Ashraf, he has these two concepts, which I explain in the book. One is this idea of azadi, and azadi in its purest form means freedom. And the other is kamai, which again in its most literal form means earnings or salary. Now, for Mohammed Ashraf, he needs to find that balance, because for Ashraf, as he once told me, I am a construction worker, but I didn't come to Delhi to build the Taj Mahal, thereby saying that, you know, there is a place for work, but there is also a place for freedom, and that our minds and our lives shouldn't be bounded by our work. So for Ashraf, he sort of is constantly looking for that balance where he can make enough money to be free.
Well, would he have some other kind of goal? Is there an ideal job that he would take if it were made available?
So at some point, I think Ashraf got obsessed with this idea of business and entrepreneurship, because I think Ashraf felt that being a businessman or being an entrepreneur means you never have to take orders from anyone. And it allows you, you know, kind of supreme, unfettered access of, I mean, sort of freedom of movement, freedom of decisions. And so there were always these sort of jobs that he tries. So at some point he sets up a stone kind of floor polishing business. At some point he sets up a kind of chicken cutting business. And I think he's always obsessed with the fact that the owners always take the largest piece of the pie. So he figures that he wants to be that person.
On the other hand, it doesn't bother him that he sleeps on the street. That can be, I realize a lot of people sleep on the street, but still that can be dangerous. It can be bad for your health. There are times when the weather doesn't make that all that easy.
Yeah.
Does he see that as freedom as well?
Right. So I think that is the sort of downside of ideas of freedom, right? And the question is, what do you value more? I mean, it's the classic idea of the gilded cage versus the kind of unbounded freedom of the wild.
Well, he describes life in Delhi in this way. He says there are two types of people here, those who pull the trigger and those who survive the shootout.
Yeah.
Well, he obviously sees himself as a survivor of the shootout.
I think so. And I think this was a moment of more kind of florid eloquence, kind of possibly fueled by something he'd been drinking. So, in fact, there's this moment where I kind of wonder whether real life actually operates on those very high stakes. And I realize that if you sleep on the street, it does.
Well, that also means that you can't be married. You write about some of his other friends, Lalu. He also has a friend named Rahan who has a get-rich plan involving goats. Are any of these people married?
Well, as it turns out, Lalu is married, but has sort of lost touch with his family. Apart from Ashraf and his friends, there are also other people who are married and are in stable relationships, where they sort of come to the city, they'll work for a month, they live on the street, even though they have a home back home, they'll save all the money they can, and then they'll go back home. So there are those kinds of people as well.
What role does ritual play in the daily lives of these people?
When you mean ritual?
Religious ritual.
Religious ritual.
Does that tie up any of their time? Do they think that if they practice religion, that their situation will get better?
So,
and how does Ashraf deal with the fact that he's contracted tuberculosis?
Right. So on the idea of ritual, there was this interesting story that someone told me while I was researching the book that didn't finally make it into the book, where there was this man I used to meet who used to drink a lot, and then I met him and he said, "I've stopped drinking." And then for 3 months I would meet him and he was completely sober. And then in the fifth month I met him and he was completely drunk again. And I said, "What happened?" And he said, you know, in the middle I got religion. And then one of the things that Hindus do is that at a certain time of the year they go to the Ganga, the source of the Ganga. They take water, they carry it on their backs, barefoot, walk back home and deposit the water at home. And the thing is, you can never let it touch the ground. So at night when you sleep, you hang it on a branch. So he did this.
And this is holy water.
This is holy water.
From what we would call the Ganges.
The Ganges, yes, the Ganges. And so he's walking home, and he's gone through 5 days, and he's been hanging it up. And on the last day, the thing snaps and breaks. And he's just like, you know, at that point, I just figured, you know, God doesn't care. Forget it. You know.
Now, what's happened with Ashraf is, have you been in touch since he went into the hospital? Because you end the book with the two of you sitting on the balcony of the TB hospital in Calcutta.
So in the epilogue, Ashraf leaves the hospital. He gives me a call and says, you know, and a friend of mine, you know, gives him a little bit of money so that he can possibly start his latest entrepreneurial venture. And around the time that I was finishing the book, I had been posted to Central India to cover this insurgency. So I'd, you know, make calls, we'd go back and forth. And then suddenly, around the time that we were correcting the galleys and I really wanted to be in touch with him to be like, hey, Ashraf, we suddenly lost touch. And time continued. And finally, I one day just got on to a train and went to Calcutta and tried to find Ashraf and was told by his friends that a couple of weeks before that, Ashraf actually died of multidrug-related tuberculosis.
Hey, is tuberculosis common among these day laborers?
Yes, very common.
Aman Sethi will be giving a reading and signing books tonight at 7 o'clock at Book Court in Brooklyn. And the book we have been discussing is called A Free Man, A True Story of Life and Death in Delhi. It is published by W.W. Norton. And my great thanks to you for doing this. Is there another book in the works, or are you just back to journalism?
I'm just back to journalism for now. Thank you very much.